Wally on the Shore by Percy Grainger, the English Chamber Orchestra there, conducted by Stuart Bedford. And as I say, Grainger, the pianist, is the subject of tonight's The Essay here on Radio 3 at 11:15. It's a little after 5 to 10, and now BBC Proms Inspire, which took place earlier this month. Here's Andrew McGregor.
Thousands of young musicians have been intimately involved in the BBC Proms for this one extraordinary and extraordinarily busy weekend. We've had youth orchestras from all over the UK playing in the Royal Albert Hall alongside the professionals, youth choirs, and the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain's annual prom, playing new pieces by Anna Meredith and Nico Mouly alongside Messiaen's immense Tarangalila Symphony. And just across the road, Proms Inspire has invaded the Royal College of Music again this year. Workshops and concerts where budding composers aged 12 to 18 can share ideas, they can experiment with new tools and techniques, they can work with professional musicians and meet other composers. And as part of Proms Inspire over the last few months, hundreds of the students have been sending in their pieces to a judging panel, which has picked their favourites. And we're going to hear the three winning pieces performed by members of the Aurora Orchestra and conductor Nicholas Collin. I'll also be catching up with the composers to find out about their music, as well as eavesdropping on the improvisation, graphic notation and electronic workshops that have been in full swing all day. I'm with composer Stephen Montague, who's been running one of the workshops in the Royal College of Music's Parry Rooms today. Graphic scoring, and I saw the billing, Stephen, that is in the little introduction to the Proms Inspire Day, and it described it as extreme sonic adventure. So what are you trying to say to the students here?
Well, I think what this was an attempt to do is to put in the context of where the graphic score is in history. And of course, you know, in the 9th century, there were kind of graphic scores as to how to remember Gregorian chant. So we kind of went through the centuries up to the 20th century and into Earl Brown, December 1952, which is probably the first contemporary graphic score. And it's mostly to sort of loosen up the students to see alternative ways of writing music that can be effective, punchy, and actually deal with a sound world that is still can be exciting.
So a new way of expressing yourself on paper, effectively, isn't it?
Well, it's not a new way. It's an old way that has been forgotten. And, you know, it's kind of interesting to reintroduce some of these old tricks, you know, by an old dog teaching the new kids some new tricks. So I'm just trying to kind of open up their world to some of the things that I learned, expand their experience to something that I think is very valuable in the firmament of music, new music.
Now, Nicky, you've been in Stephen's workshop this afternoon. Were you used to any of these kind of ways of expressing yourself on paper, or is this new to you?
It's reasonably new. I mean, I've seen some types of graphic scores before, but I'd definitely never seen certainly most of the stuff from before the 20th century. Looking at all the monk chants, how they used to notate their music, that's really interesting, and I found it quite strange because I didn't actually know they had to remember so much music, so I can see now why they came up with the notation that they did.
What sort of impact do you feel it could have on you as a composer yourself? Do you feel that it does sort of extend your manuscript vocabulary, if you like, give you new possibilities?
Yeah, definitely, because, you know, Stephen said to us that there's a lot of things that Sibelius can't do, and I think there's a lot of effects and even sounds that you can't actually achieve without some kinds of these. You sort of create your own key in a way, and yeah, you can show people different sort of ways of bringing in and out instruments and that kind of thing that is really difficult to do accurately on paper, usually with normal notation methods.
So there's a new kind of accuracy about the way you're expressing yourself.
Yeah, I suppose a lot of it is less kind of in the sense of counting and like when does this beat come where, but instead you actually have a visual thing to bring you in or show you where to play which bits. So it definitely helps ensemble skills as well, because it helps everyone listen to each other, and you can all work together to listen to what one person is doing and take that and use it when you play your piece.
Now let's hear the first winning piece from the Young Composers Competition. It's called Mirmish. It's by 17-year-old Alex Wolfe. And Alex, it's inspired by W.B. Yeats, a passage of Yeats. So what's the story and how's it become music?
Well, there was just six lines of text that really struck me from this poem by Yeats. And it seems to encapsulate such a strong narrative, and it has a huge emotional breadth in such a small space of time. And for this competition, where our pieces have to be under 5 minutes, it seemed to have the perfect sense of clarity for the piece that I wanted to write.
Now, what's the poem?
The poem is called The Mermaid, I believe, by Yeats, and it's just these six lines from it. It's all about a young lad who's swimming at sea, and the mermaid kind of fixates on him, and they kind of get entangled, and eventually it says she forgets that even lovers drown, and it's just got this little twist at the end, and it's quite poignant and quite beautiful, I thought.
And how have you actually drawn the characters into the score? And what should we listen out for?
Well, it's for bassoon and string quartet, so initially quite an unconventional ensemble. I've thought of the string quartet as both the sea and the mermaid, kind of drawing and enticing the bassoonist's young lad, the young swimming lad, in, if you like. And they get intertwined, the cello and the bassoon particularly press into each other with the same note and a semitone apart, and I've tried to capture the sort of both the kind of ecstatic feeling in the poem and the reverse of that.
And why Mirmish, not quite a mermaid?
Mirmish, well, I love the Harry Potter books, and the mermaids in those speak this funny language, which is not necessarily how you expect mermaids to speak, and it's called Mirmish in the Harry Potter books. I thought this might be my interpretation of the language of the mermaids.
Thank you. A Swimmer Drowned by an Over-Amorous Mermaid. That's Mermish by Alex Wolfe, one of our two junior winners of the BBC Proms Inspire Young Composers Competition. And you'll hear the other one and our senior winner just a little later. We've been listening to the practical improvisation workshop this afternoon, the subject of which is groove. Now, Jules Buckley, this is your workshop. Define groove. You have 10 seconds.
Well, groove should be anything that's locked into a point that's making people want to move.
Can you teach it? Isn't this just something that people have to feel?
It's the old adage. I think you can totally teach it, yeah. I mean, if some guy's spent his whole life playing or having a particular penchant for romantic music and then you play him a James Brown record, then, you know, there's a good chance perhaps initially he might not be so down with the beat, but I'm sure by just explaining what to listen for and how to feel it, I'm sure that everybody can groove, basically. It's just a case of trying to unlock it as fast as possible.
And how have you been doing that with the students you've had today?
Well, we just focus on a few really simple tasks or a few simple riffs. And the main thing was what we call, I guess, in the music world, of subdividing and where the emphasis lies, and also upon kind of moving and dancing and putting those things together and working on different exercises, like take one simple riff, if it's not happening immediately, slow it down, effectively like magnifying something in, having a look at it and then get that tight and then speed it up. It's a very simple process, actually. But a lot of classical musicians don't think like that, so. Which is not a bad thing. It's just they don't
have to
do
it. Yeah. Now, Emily, you've been one of Jules' students in the workshop this afternoon. And what do you play?
Well, I brought my violin today, but I play a mixture of things: piano, guitar, singing.
And is this kind of workshop familiar to you? Are you somebody who's needs the groove unlocking, if you like to?
Well,
to use what Jules was saying.
It's funny because you said about classical musicians, it's, I find it harder. And I played violin in orchestras before, and you do find that it's harder for syncopation and things like that for them to really grab it. But because I also play in a band and other things like that, it's a bit easier when you know the more kind of popular music sort of thing. It's just easier if you can pick up a beat. It's like some people get it, some people can't. It doesn't mean you can't teach it to them.
And do you find it's easy to actually bring those things across from the band experiences through to classical composition, if you like?
Oh yeah, no, it's really helpful. It means like you can draw things from different areas of music that you're interested in, because I'm interested in pretty much everything. I can draw things from different areas of music and put it into one thing. So say I was composing something that's classical but maybe a little bit more contemporary, I can take something from jazz or take something from rock that might kind of help that to make it a little bit more quirky. So that's basically what we're dealing with today. So we've got a lot of classical musicians coming, and a lot of the pieces they compose are quite contemporary, but in the kind of improvisational thing we did with Jules, that was very kind of jazzy and more popular music, which is really good because it gets them to think about other things.
Thank you. Now it's time to hear the senior winner's piece from the Young Composers Competition. It's by Sarah Gate. It's called Portrait of a Moor. We're about to hear its first public performance. Now, Sarah, Portrait of a Moor, there's a picture behind this. Explain where the inspiration came from and what image we ought to have in our heads.
Yes, the inspiration was from a picture by James Northcote. It's actually a portrait of the American actor Ira Aldridge in the title role of Shakespeare's Othello, and it's called Othello, the Moor of Venice. And I was just really intrigued by the look on the subject's face, because it's a really jealous look, and his eyes are raised slightly, and around the edges of the painting it's very murky. Then it comes into focus on the features of his face, and I wanted to reflect that in the piece. So the piece moves from a more murky sound world with a lot of unusual techniques to an intense focus.
And you've taken some of the physical aspects of the picture as well, haven't you? The sort of folds and layers that
you can
see.
And the colour scheme too. The artist used a very restricted colour scheme, just brown, black and white, shades of that. And I've concentrated the harmonic and melodic writing on just two intervals, the fifth and the semitone, and because they're quite contrasting intervals, and based all the pitch material on that to make it quite focused too.
Thank you.
Portrait of a Moor by Sarah Gate, taking her inspiration from a 19th century painting of an actor playing Shakespeare's Othello. And it was played there by the Aurora Orchestra, conducted by Nicholas Collin, the senior winner in the Young Composers Competition. I'm backstage at the Royal College of Music with composer Anna Meredith. And Anna, you've been presiding over almost every aspect of this in some way, shape or form. So tell us what your role's been so far.
I've been really lucky to be part of all aspects of the Inspire Day. I've been part of the hubs, where we've taken some workshops out to regions of the UK and introduced the idea of composing to some people who've never maybe composed before. I was also a judge on the competition. And then today, on this amazing day where we're bringing all sorts of aspects together, I've run a workshop, and then I've also here in my capacity as the National Youth Orchestra's composition tutor.
And when you bring these young people, these young composers together like this, it must be quite exciting just seeing the sparks and the light bulbs flashing as people get ideas and realise what's possible.
I think that's what's so great about this day, is the diversity of things that are open to these composers. This is not a restrictive, you must do this, this is how you write for Flute Day, this is a, have you ever tried thinking about a big graphic gestures or loop-based music or electronics. These are really sort of door-opening ideas, and I think these young composers are going to go away and hopefully be turned on their heads in terms of the way of thinking.
Now, the ones that are involved with the National Youth Orchestra's composition programme, the NYO Hub, they get a particularly good grounding and opportunity. Describe the way in which that's been happening over their courses.
Yeah, the NYO Creative Hub course runs in parallel to the main orchestral course. So it's really intense, because the orchestra rehearses incredibly hard. We do 2 weeks at Christmas, 2 weeks at Easter, and 2 weeks in the summer in a different place in the UK. So we'll be in residence at university or a school. And over those 2 weeks, we'll have 7 or 8 teenage composers who essentially are with myself and the other composition tutors, Larry Goves and Chris Mayo, kind of 12 hours a day, you know, listening to music, trying ideas. So it's a very intense environment, but they get to try stuff for the orchestra, they get to write pieces for instruments they've never written for before. So this is the culmination of our kind of year-long programme, and it's been a real kind of honour to work actually with these young composers so much. Got very attached to them, we spend a lot of time together.
And we've been able to hear the results, the compositions themselves by these young composers from the NYO, performed by members of the NYO in a concert this afternoon. So, well, pick one of them for us and introduce it. What was one that you find a particular highlight?
Well, we gave the composers an unusual brief of asking them to invent an Olympic sport and then write some music for it. So we had some really fantastic ideas and approaches, but one that really caught my imagination is from a fantastic young composer called Benjamin Weatherfield, who wrote a piece very evocatively titled Rhythmic Gymnastics with Lions, and he's really managed to capture the precariousness and fear of this rhythmic gymnastics done under this sort of growling tension of the lions underneath.
Thank you. Rhythmic Gymnastics with Lions by Benjamin Weatherfield, one of the seven young composers from the NYO Hub who've been working with Anna Meredith and whose pieces were performed by members of the National Youth Orchestra conducted by Jerry Cornelius in the first concert in this Proms Inspire Day. Now it's time to hear the last of our three winners in the Proms Inspire Young Composers competition. It's the second of the junior winners, Freddie Myers, 15 years old, and this is Three Apparitions for Large Orchestra. Now Freddie's with me. What's behind the title, Freddie? Where are these three apparitions? Where are they from?
Well, I first draw the idea from Scrooge's Christmas Carol, where Scrooge is visited by three ghosts. And this is the same sort of idea, except the ghosts in my piece are of fear, love and death.
And a 12-note row in these three movements as well. Are you a committed serialist, or is this an experiment?
I'm quite happy to experiment with different ideas. I've done minimalist pieces before. I've done, you know, completely tonal pieces. I like to experiment with different sort of ways of composing.
And so we have the same row throughout, but three movements, three different moods as well.
Yes, very. I tried to contrast all the different moods so that there were three different, very separate movements.
Three Apparitions by Freddie Myers, inspired by Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. Freddie's short serialist work in three movements, and he's our second junior winner. It was played there by the Aurora Orchestra, conducted by Nicholas Collin. Now, one of the workshops we've been eavesdropping on at the Royal College of Music this afternoon has been called In Search of New Sonic Expressions. And it's been run by Mike Roberts, who's head of electronic music at the Guildhall School in London, and some of his students. And the idea has been to explore electronic technology and the way it can enrich and expand the sounds available to composers. Now, Grace and Adam are with me from that workshop, both 17-year-olds. And Adam, do you get to play with this kind of technology whenever you want it, or are there things here that are new to you?
Well, in GCSE, when I was in year 10 and year 11, we, for composition, We only used Logic, which was sort of gave me an understanding of electronic music, and I was quite sort of used to it when we did it.
So some of this is very familiar to you, but yeah. What about the kinds of techniques that are being talked about? And I know you've only got a brief time to actually play with it and work together on these things, but they must be coming up with some quite interesting ideas for you.
Yeah, we use sort of plugins. Plugins are sort of, you know, delay, reverb, and how you can expand on that to create a different sound. So we're using just a simple click or something, and then suddenly you can change that into an actual tuning, so you can create a piece of music of just a sound. That's sort of what we were trying to figure.
Now, Grace, when you're writing music of your own, is this the kind of thing that you naturally reach for, or is some of this really new tools as far as you're concerned?
Not generally. Usually I'd use Sibelius and working with real instruments and stuff. But I mean, I'm loving all these ideas that they're giving us about finding sort of new voices, I suppose, and new sounds to work with and just make new tunes and all sorts with. Like, it's really inspiring, actually, just, yeah, being able to create your own instruments with literally sounds, and almost anything that you see you can pick up and make a noise with and create a completely new sound that no one else has ever been able to record like that before.
So you've suddenly got a whole new canvas, a whole new world of possibilities opening up in front of you. That must be, well, it could be quite frightening, actually. Where do you start?
I don't know. They had a few folders where I suppose you could take it down to sort of kitchen noises, where I know they use, like, dragging a spoon down a cooling rack and recording that, and that had sort of reverb after it and all sorts, and stuff like pans and everything. And so I suppose you could put it into sort of groups, like kitchen stuff, nature maybe, like using water and droplets and all sorts like that.
And as somebody who's probably, from the sound of it, more used to using conventional orchestral instruments and the sorts of things that you'd expect in classical music, did you suddenly find yourself thinking, I'm getting excited about all the different kinds of ways I could use these with what I already know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it's really great. You can sort of mix them as well. So I'm sure you could find a way of joining in, like, all these different sounds with the orchestral instruments. And, yeah, just creating new combinations. I mean, there's just a world of possibilities. So it's just finding whatever you are inspired by and just create new stuff with it.
Thank you. Some of the sounds emerging from the electronics workshop that's been going on all day, one of the workshops at the Royal College of Music. And we've met some of the students who hopefully have been inspired by everything they've discovered and the encounters they've had today. But there was so much more from the concert that we haven't had time to play you, the runners-up. So the least we thought we could do was to leave you with just a taste of the 10 talented composers whose pieces were performed by the Aurora Orchestra's musicians in the concert. They make a pretty colourful collage.
Thank you. fantastic means dinner will be served at half tiger. I try to throw the ball to Tony, but it won't move if there's still petrol in the safe. Now if Dobby loves what I missed, Anthony in Grasshopper reproduction, it's not going to sink.
Collage of some of the highly commended entries in this year's Proms Inspire competition, played by the Aurora Orchestra and singer Miriam Allen, conducted by Nicholas Collin. Featured were extracts of works by Bryony Connor, Daniel Hogan, Christopher Bowman, Toby Hessian, Joshua Hagley, Aditya Chanda, Rob Jones, Frankie Perry, Joss Smith and Samuel Hall. And that survey of Proms Inspire was hosted by Andrew McGregor. Well, the BBC Proms aren't the only live events here on Radio 3 at the moment. Jamie McDougall explains.
3 weeks of music on BBC Radio 3 from the Edinburgh International Festival. Every weekday morning at 11 o'clock, a stellar lineup of musicians, including Sir Thomas Allen, Leifover Adsness, Rebecca Evans, John Williams and John Etheridge, Clay Williams and the Australian Chamber Orchestra. And tomorrow, the violinist Leonidas Kavakos and the brilliant Russian pianist Nikolai Lugansky team up to bring us a recital of sonatas by Janáček, Brahms, Stravinsky and Respighi. Our week from Edinburgh continues live tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
And if you missed Sir Thomas Allen earlier in the week, or Trio Zimmermann, for example, in fact, any of the Edinburgh relays, just a reminder of listen again, the iPlayer, in high-definition sound, that's via the Radio 3 homepage. It's a quarter to 11 and time now for the last of three essay programmes we're repeating this week, devoted to different aspects of Percy Grainger, the Australian-born composer and pianist who died in 1961. Tonight, the pianist Lucy Parham looks at Grainger, the pianist, and begins with one of Grainger's own recordings.
Unmistakable celebratory sounds of Edvard Grieg's Wedding Day at Trollhaugen, played by the Australian-born pianist and composer Percy Grainger in a recording made in 1921. And that piece takes me back to the recital I gave at the Bergen Festival in Norway recently, when I was playing at the New Hall at Trollhaugen. It's attached to Grieg's house, which is now a museum nestling in the heart of the Norwegian countryside. After the concert, I was offered the chance to play on Grieg's Steinway piano, which sits in the middle of his very homely sitting room with its panoramic views of the Norwegian fjords. What was special for me was that this was the same piano that Grainger would have played when he visited Grieg at this very house during the summer of 1907. Looking at the picture of the two composers sitting side by side, I realise it captured a fleeting moment of a relationship that was to be sadly short-lived. Percy Grainger and Grieg first met in London the previous year and had corresponded regularly since then. When they met, Grieg was astonished to learn that Grainger had his Norwegian folk songs and peasant dances in his repertoire. He was ecstatic with Grainger's interpretations of these works, especially as they'd not received a particularly glowing reception when they were first published. And so, the following year, in 1907, Grieg invited the young Grainger to his home in Bergen. Grainger was due to perform Grieg's piano concerto at the Leeds Festival, and during his visit to Norway, the two musicians spent many hours working and revising the piece together. Grieg declared that he had to wait until he was 64 years old to hear Norwegian piano music interpreted so understandingly and brilliantly. In fact, he was so impressed with Grainger that he wrote to all the influential newspapers and critics about the young pianist. Grieg truly believed that Grainger was the next Anton Rubinstein, the great Russian pianist and pedagogue, and because of this, he set about trying to further his career in Europe. After the very intense time the two musicians spent together, it was a great loss for Grainger when Grieg died just a few months later, tragically thwarting their brief, though mutually rewarding, relationship. In 1921, Grainger recorded Grieg's concerto on piano roll, and there are also four recordings of him performing the work live. In fact, Grieg's piano works remained very close to Grainger's heart throughout his life, with him performing them all over the world and even editing a special edition of the concerto. But how had the young Australian musician developed into the extraordinarily talented pianist that so captivated Edvard Grieg over 100 years ago? Percy Grainger was born into a middle-class home in Melbourne, but his parents separated when he was only 8. His mother, Rose, paid huge attention to nurturing his artistic abilities in writing, history and the arts, and she herself was, as Percy later described, the strongest influence on his artistic life. Her love of poetry and the arts were always evident, and Grainger acknowledged that he never failed to get support, criticism and instinctive insight from his mother. Rose was a keen pianist herself, and when Percy was just five, she began teaching him the piano. He later remembered what he called the rhythmic robustness of her piano playing and how her saucy and almost naive gracefulness endowed her playing with an irresistibly winsome lilt. Having felt her young son was outgrowing her lessons, the ambitious Rose Granger set about finding him a better teacher. In Louis Pabst, she discovered a teacher who'd studied with Anton Rubinstein and someone who'd educate her son in the much-lauded Russian school of piano playing. It was through Pabst that Granger became obsessed with the music of Bach, the passion that never left him throughout his performing life. And it was with Bach, his B-flat partita, that the 12-year-old made his public debut in 1894. He despised what he called the sewing machine way of playing Bach, preferring to play it in a more romantic style, using lots of rubato and a more idiosyncratic style of interpretation. But Pabst wanted to return to Europe, and because he wasn't keen on Granger pursuing his love of composition, the two parted company. But ironically, they were to remain geographically close. Spurred on by the critical success of his debut and with the occasional financial support of his father, Percy and his highly ambitious mother made the long and arduous journey to Frankfurt. It was here Percy became a student of both the piano and of composition at the Hoch Conservatorium, which was then one of Europe's leading music schools. In fact, the legendary Clara Schumann had been head of piano here just a few years previously. During the next few years, Rose taught English and music to earn enough money to support them both, and at the tender age of only 14, Percy was being hailed as a prodigy in Germany. Although he later wrote that he learnt very little from his new teacher, he did gain some invaluable musical experiences at this time. Being exposed to many other performers, some of legendary status, his attitude to performing was transformed. When, for example, he heard Eugen Dalbert, a legendary pupil of Franz Liszt, his experience proved electrifying. At this time, Granger's mother became increasingly unwell, and he decided to make London their base. Settling into the city, the connections that Granger built up in London society quickly enabled him to build up his public following and find patronage from some of the wealthy elite. Having played at Steinway Hall, he was presented to royalty and commanded to play at Buckingham Palace, with his colonial affiliations proving a useful way of finding performance opportunities in high society. He received numerous invitations to play in fashionable salons, which he loathed, but he desperately needed the money. Granger's choice of repertoire was always controversial. He never played Mozart, Haydn, or Beethoven, bizarrely believing Beethoven to be a frivolous composer. But Bach always featured prominently, alongside his own and others' transcriptions of Bach's works. Granger loved playing the big romantic giants like Chopin, Schumann and Brahms, although he wasn't too complimentary about Brahms the man, referring to him as the composer who had a delicate and tender heart but was well encased in sausages. And if I find that statement a bit hard to swallow, I only need to listen to Granger's recordings to be reminded of just what a truly great pianist he was. I first heard his 1927 recording of Schumann's G minor sonata some years ago when I was studying the work myself. And what becomes immediately apparent is that the mind of the composer at work is always foremost. Where many pianists play this piece so fast you can barely recognise it, Granger has paid attention to every detail, really trying to get into Schumann's very complex mind. For him, tempo seems to be a means to an end. In fact, he used to tell his students that tempo marking should never be taken too literally, and that each performer would find their own voice through discovering their own tempo. He stressed that the most important thing should always be the music, and what lay at the heart of the piece was what counted the most. During his long and exhausting tours of South Africa, Australia and England, Granger also championed the then unfamiliar works of Ravel, Albéniz and Debussy. And his own compositions were a tremendous success with the public too, many of them virtuosic transcriptions and arrangements, with the most famous being the ever-hummable Country Gardens. The popularity of Granger's works was spreading quickly, and it's only when you listen to his transcriptions and original compositions for the piano that you realise his true stature as a composer-pianist. Granger's friendships with other composers of that time, like Cyril Scott, Charles Villiers Stanford and Roger Quilter, resulted in many of their own pieces being transcribed or dished up, as he liked to call it. Granger transformed a bewildering amount of material and touched it with a golden hand of genius to make it truly unique. Here is a pianist that seemed to have no difficulty in covering the keys, gliding and weaving around the most ferociously challenging pieces. He called some of his works free rambles, and you can see why, as his unique improvisatory style is always at the forefront of these compositions. When you listen to his paraphrase of Tchaikovsky's famous Waltz of the Flowers from The Nutcracker, it's truly staggering how Granger manages to fit several layers of the orchestration into two hands and then improvise over the top of that. It's a technical feat that just leaves you speechless, and the highly florid cadenza at the end would have had people clamouring for more. But in spite of that, you never get the sense that the music gets lost amid the virtuosity. Granger seemed to have developed a love-hate relationship with the piano, which prevailed throughout his life. I love the fact that he once declared that he loathed the piano because he considered it an affront to destroy a melodiously conceived idea by trying to fit it into what he called the limitations of two hands and a box full of hammers and strings. Not that that was Granger's only controversial view on playing the piano. It seems that many of his attitudes to playing the piano would cause a few raised eyebrows. For example, he believed scales were a waste of time and that you should always find your practice material from within the pieces you were studying at that time. Actually, I think there's a lot of sense in that, but I doubt whether that was something that his teachers would have encouraged. The complex technique of pedalling and all its permutations of half-pedalling, flutter-pedalling and sostenuto-pedalling were also things he continuously stressed. And rather ahead of his time, Granger was devoted to physical fitness, almost verging on an obsession, which is something I think you can hear with the abundance of energy that typifies his piano playing. He never walked where he could run somewhere, and he kept a chinning bar in his sitting room, which he used every day. When Granger moved to America in 1914 with his by now very ailing mother, he even managed to eclipse the huge pianistic success he'd achieved in Europe. The Americans adored him, and through his sold-out concerts, he became one of the most sought-after performers of the time. Pieces like Country Gardens and Handel in the Strand became highly successful and popular there too, with sheet music sales breaking many publishing records. And they'd often be the pieces that the public were clamouring to hear at the end of his long recitals. Although by now he'd become an American citizen, when his mother committed suicide, the devastated Granger sought solace in his work and returned to Europe for a year. Performing was always to remain integral to his life. Percy Granger's thinking is often referred to as different or eccentric. There are numerous stories of his antics and outlandish performance habits, such as bounding down the central aisle of a concert hall during the opening drum roll of the Grieg Concerto and somersaulting onto the stage just in time to play the opening piano chords. But at heart, I think Granger always felt he was a composer rather than a pianist and wanted posterity to remember him like that. He was part of that elite group of composer-pianists, joining the likes of Liszt, Busoni, Godofsky and Rachmaninoff. But ironically, without his highly developed understanding of the piano, Granger could never have composed the masterpieces he did. He His knowledge of the instrument was always central to his compositions, with all of them being very pianist-friendly for the performer. Sadly, he seemed to regard his career as a virtuoso pianist with distaste. But the public didn't agree, and Granger leaves a performance and recording legacy that's just as strong as his compositions. And for that, we, as performers and listeners, should be extremely grateful.
Lucy Parham, ending this week's series of programmes about Percy Granger. For the essay, Aspects of Granger, is a Potten Hall production for BBC Radio 3. The producer was Jeremy Hayes, and the programmes were first broadcast in September last year. In an hour and a half tonight, Radio 3 Through the Night sets off with a recent concert from Romania, the George Enescu Philharmonic, in Beethoven's First Symphony and the Romanian Concerto by the Hungarian George Ligeti. That's quite a rarity. 12:30, starting time for that. BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's 11 o'clock. And now Late Junction with Verity Sharp.
L'amore mio non può disperdersi nel vento con le rose, tanto è forte che non cederà, non sfiorirà. Io lo veglierò, io lo difenderò da tutte quelle insidie velenose che vorrebbero strapparlo al cuore, povero amore. Forse te ne andrai da altri amori, le carezze cercherai, ahimè. E se tornerai già sfiorita, la passione troverai. L'amore no, l'amore mio non può dissolversi con l'oro dei capelli. Finché io vivo, sarà vivo in me, solo per te. Con l'oro dei capelli, finché io vivo, sarà vivo in me, solo per te.
Anyone who's anyone has recorded that song over the years. Mala Moreno, Everything But Love, as sung there by Orchestra Coco on their debut album. Welcome to Late Junction. Here are the Hot Seats with the Mineola Rag.